Hey, welcome back to another edition of Leave the Ring Radio. I didn't put it on the Block Talk, guys. I apologize. I know some folks wanted to call in, but to tell you the truth, man, I still haven't figured it out how to link it up. It's a pain in the ass. I can't bring in my guest who I wanted on today, so we're just going to do it straight from YouTube, and then I'll post up the MP3 onto the Block Talk. But let me welcome my guest here, the senior writer for Boxing Scene, Keith Eidick. How you doing, brother?
I'm good, Dave. How you doing, man? Thanks for having me.
Good, man. Good. So how are you coping with everything, man? How are you doing? How's your daily life been? Has it changed a whole lot, or are you still kind of just going about your normal business?
It's obviously changed for all of us in the world, of course. You know, just right. Not going out and all. You know, just trying to adhere to everything they tell us. And you know, I live in New Jersey, so there are well over 100,000 cases here in New Jersey, and about 6,000 deaths or so now. So it's been, you know, it's been tough out here, in New York, New Jersey area and everything. Right. It's been rough, but thankfully no one in my family is sick or no one close to me is sick. So, you know, just counting my blessings. And from a work standpoint, it's interesting because everyone's stuck at home and they're looking for things to do. You know, that the site generates a lot of traffic usually anyway, but it hasn't tailed off as much as we expected because I think people are home and they're looking for stuff to read. You know, of course, there are no live fights for us, and that's, you know, so on Saturdays, traffic is down a little bit. From a workload standpoint, I mean, we're still cranking stuff out every day, and there's just no traveling, and I do, you know, obviously do a lot of traveling for the job. So from that standpoint, that's, you know, I haven't had to leave the house for work for 7 weeks or so, which is unusual, but overall, just, you know, we're just lucky to be healthy, and I think that's all we can look at it. That's the way all of us can look at it at this point, right, Dave?
Exactly, you know, and I bet you the interviews are coming a lot easier than before when everybody was functioning, because I know that when I'm doing interviews, it's always like he can't do it at this time because he's not going to be here, or there's like a waiting game. How's that been going for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's been easier to get guys on the phone because, you know, guys not that they're making excuses, but no one's really busy doing what they're ordinary, even training. Guys aren't, for the most part, training at this point. So, yeah, it's been easier to get guys on the phone. And I think people are bored and boxers generally like to talk. I mean, there are some exceptions, but most of them like to talk and everything. So it's been, they've been accessible, and that's been helpful, you know, getting our jobs done. And we definitely appreciate the cooperation.
Exactly, man. So let me ask you this, and we'll definitely jump into our topic in a short bit here, but I wanted to get some of your background. I mean, why boxing? Why did you decide to pick to do journalistic stuff in boxing?
Well, I'll give you a short story about how I fell into covering boxing. I started at a newspaper in New Jersey in 1993. I was still a senior in college when I worked there. I was the low man on the totem pole. I was a part-time employee, one of the few people on the staff who knew anything about boxing. And I covered a lot of other sports. I covered the NFL for 14, 15 years, covered, you know, a variety of other sports at the collegiate, high school and professional levels for 23 years altogether. It wound up being, but boxing was always one of my specialties. We had a writer who covered boxing at the paper, and she was a fascinating lady. She covered for decades. She covered boxing, a German woman named Rosemarie Ross. So she covered it, and she wound up leaving the paper. This was late in 1996, and I was basically the only person on the staff that knew a lot about boxing. So they said, "You're the boxing writer." That's how it kind of happened. And I never dreamed when I was in college that, you know, 25 years later or whatever, my full-time occupation would be covering boxing. It's worked out amazingly well. I love the sport, obviously, and it's just crazy how you wind up doing things with your life that you never anticipated.
Exactly. You know, let me ask you this, because I'm always fascinated with the folks that are in the business. You know, I've been, you know, been doing this for quite some time, not as long as you've been doing it. You know, I've been reading your stuff for quite some time. So this is actually a real treat for me, man, to get a chance to speak. We've kind of had like few little, you know, very small conversations on Twitter, but never really had a chance to have a convo, you know, direct to each other through Skype and stuff. Who was the toughest interview for you in boxing? Whether it was a fighter, a promoter, or anything else, publicist, who was the toughest for you to have an interview where you had to really kind of like dig deep to them and find what's made them spark, you know, to even get something drawn out of them?
Well, first, Dave, thanks for the kind words, man. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you reading all these years, too. And it's my pleasure to come on. You know, I'd say that the toughest interview, and I don't know that it was in the sense that you couldn't get anything out of him. It was just that you didn't know what he was going to do. And it was Mike Tyson. You know, because as a kid, you know, I was in high school. Mike Tyson was a phenomenon, right? I mean, he's this, you know, world-renowned. Well, he did a lot of crazy things, obviously, but he was infamous or world-famous, however you want to look at it. So when I was covering, you know, he was toward the end of his career when I was first started covering boxing, and the first time you're around him, you just don't know how, you know, he was in a very volatile stage in his life. I mean, he's much more mellow now and everything. He's easier to talk to, but you just know what was going to set him off and how he was going to react in certain ways. And there were times, you know, we interviewed mostly in group settings, you know, but still you just didn't know what he was going to say or do and what might make him snap, or, you know, even the most innocuous question might set him off. So you just really didn't know how he was going to react. So I think that's what I draw on probably as the most unusual or difficult interview, because he was just so unpredictable.
Man, I mean, you know, I remember when he went off on that one reporter. I'm trying to remember his name. Remember when he started grabbing himself and he was like, you know, I'll F you until you love me. and I forget, what was the name of that reporter, man? I have it in the back of my head.
His name is Scoop Malinowski. His name is Mark Malinowski, right?
Yeah.
So I was there, Dave. I was there that day, and I know Scoop from covering football. I covered the Giants for a decent amount of time, and Scoop was he covered football back then, Jets and Giants games and everything. So I knew him for a long time, and when that whole thing happened, you know, it was January of 2002, and I can still remember being in that hotel in Manhattan where they had the press conference. And like, if you told someone, if you were making up a story, you couldn't have made up anything more absurd than happened that day. He bit Lennox Lewis's leg, and then, you know, that wasn't the craziest thing that he did. He bit his opponent's leg, and that wasn't the nuttiest thing that happened. So, you know, it's funny. Like, he was it was open to the public. So there were just random tourists in there.
Right.
And when he started grabbing his crotch and saying, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, there was a couple – he was looking in my – he wasn't talking to me. Uh-huh. But there was like – it looked like he was talking to this couple that looked like they were from Minnesota or Wisconsin or something like that. And they were horrified. So they were like, let's get out of here before Mike Tyson gets off this stage. But as he's going nuts, Dave, that's when Scoop, who again, I've known for a long time, just blurts out, "Get him a straitjacket." And I don't think he realized how loud he said it, nor that Tyson was going to turn around and react the way that he did.
Right.
Tyson hears what he says, and somehow his back seemed to be turned when he said it, but he knew who said it because he pointed right at him when he turned around.
Yep.
And that's when he said, "I'm going to F you till you love me," on all this crazy stuff. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, is this happening? Is this really? And then I went back to the office, to the newspaper office from there. And it's like, and it was already on CNN and everywhere. And I'm like, guys, you are not going to believe. And they're like, get out of here. That didn't happen. And they know Scoop. So they're like, wait, he was yelling at Scoop. I said, yes. So
it was something else, man. I wonder how much toilet paper Scoop used that night.
Dave, it was crazy. I mean, it was every bit as crazy as it looks in that YouTube video. It was that crazy. It was unbelievable. I still can't believe it happened almost 20 years later.
Man, I got to tell you, that's pretty ballsy of you after that, though, you know, to even interview him, man, because it seemed like he had two targets, white guys and women. You know what I mean? Those are the targets that end up setting him off at that time. You know, he just went ballistic with everybody. But yeah, Scoop, I mean – I think after that, even Scoop got into further trouble with some of the stuff he would say, like even on his Facebook and stuff. And I don't know what happened to him, but I remember that specifically when Mike Tyson turned around. That's a great story, man. They were saying, like I said, I wonder how much Scoop, how much toilet paper Scoop used on that night after when he was pointed, you know, Mike Tyson pointed right at him, man, because I'd be shitting bricks.
If he ran it out of there, it was like, you know, in the old cartoons when they'd have the cutout of the person running through the wall. It was like one of those things. And he was, and I remember it was a couple of days before Shane Mosley fought Vernon Forrest at the theater at the Garden. Uh-huh. And I saw they had a, you know, like a media dining room set up basically in the theater. And it was like 3 days after that, maybe. And I saw Scoop and I said, "Are you all right, man? Are you?" And he's like, "No, I'm fine. I'm fine." Like, almost like nothing happened. I was like, "Dude, I saw you run out of, you were like Carl Lewis running out of the building. I mean, come on." You know?
Oh, I wish I would have been there. That would have been so great, man. You know, but so let me ask you this. What is boxing to you?
What is boxing to me, you said?
Yeah. What is boxing to you?
Well, it's a big part of my life, obviously. You know, you spend so much time working and you spend so much time around it. It's a huge part of your life, you know, and it's like, as you know, Dave, it's a marginalized sport in the United States now, and you know, it's a niche sport and everything, but it consumes your life. I mean, because the thing is, I think even as an objective reporter, you do, you know, you learn these guys' stories and you kind of mm-hmm. realize how much is at stake for them every time they go in the ring and how much it impacts their families' well-beings and their own well-beings. And also, you know, they literally, and I never lose sight of this, it's something that I think sometimes when you're just going through day after day, sometimes you can, but they literally risk their lives every time they go in there. They honestly don't, you don't want to be melodramatic, but they honestly don't know every time they walk up those steps whether they're going to walk back down. So I kind of like, you know, when people like flippantly criticize guys, I'm like, look, this is a very different thing to do for a living. And while, you know, some guys, I'm not saying some guys have the same amount of fortitude as every guy has the same amount of fortitude or anything, I just think people should be more careful, I guess is what I'm saying, of being critical of fighters, because it takes even the worst fighter, it takes a lot of balls to go in there and do what they do.
It does. You know, I mean, look, you're getting hit in the face. Who likes to do that? It's not normal. I've always said to kids walking in the gyms, even when I used to work with my kids, and even to myself, when I, you know, used to box in the amateurs and stuff, I used to tell folks, you got to be a little nuts. There's got to be something wrong up there, man, to want to get hit, you know. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, if it was, you know, I like what you say. It is a niche sport. And I don't know about you, though. I kind of like it that it's a niche sport here in the States. You know, it's not the number one sport, obviously. Obviously, we would like that. But I like the fact that fans can actually cover it, you know, to an extent. Sometimes there's some fans where you just kind of cringe and be like, maybe this is not your thing. You just take a seat back. But I do like the fact that, you know, boxing has always been a step ahead than the other sports, even though it's been a niche sport. What I mean by like the OTT, the, you know, the internet, you know, Max Boxing, Boxing Scene, when they came around, you know, and in like YouTube, you know, I was one of the, like the 10 or I don't remember how many guys that started up on a YouTube channel and started talking boxing. So I've always enjoyed that, man. But if I had the power to change certain things in the sport to make it better, it definitely would be, you know, judging. I'm not one to like complain all the time and bitch and moan on Twitter to fighters, call them bums. I don't believe in that, just like what you mentioned right now, because these guys put their lives on the line. But I do like to complain about, not complain, but point out about PEDs usage, how we have to have more stricter testing, 365 days. But the other thing too is judging. I don't want to criticize the judging, because you know what? I watched the fight and in the process of being on social media, have said this particular person won the round, and then somebody else is like, what are you, blind, and blah, 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 right? You know, but I would like to learn the process of what they do to teach these judges, Keith, of how to judge a fight. And I think that would give us a much bigger understanding of what these judges are looking for. Are they fresh? Do they have fresh eyes? Do they really understand the sport? Do they understand the system that is in place to score a fight? You know, my old co-host, Gabriel Montoya, once mentioned, you know, it'd be nice that if they put like a camera, you know, one of those, those cameras you put on the top of your head and you could see what they're seeing. What do you think?
A judge cam would be an excellent idea. You know, I think one thing that gets lost sometimes, and look, it, like everything else, Dave, some judges are just better than others, just like some boxers are better than others.
Right.
Some writers are better than others. Some, you know, podcasts are better than others, but I just think that's human nature. But I think sometimes something that gets lost is the angle that a judge is sitting at, because sometimes their view is blocked from seeing certain things. Whereas, as you know, one judge on the other side might see a clean punch land, whereas the judge who's, you know, with the fighter's back turned in front of that judge might not see that. Yep. So I think, you know, sometimes we're overly critical. It's a natural part of covering boxing, and I think being a fan of boxing, you want them to get it right every single time. Not sometimes, not most times. Every single time you want to see them get it right. And if you see a judge consistently either getting it wrong or not getting it as right as the other judges, people are going to complain, as you said, and they should. I mean, they should. The other thing is, it's a very subjective science, Dave, as you know, you well know, right? So I think sometimes, you know, one thing that I think is undervalued in judging boxing is defense. Defense is one of the criteria for judging boxing. And I think sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle a little bit. If a guy's a tremendous defensive fighter, you could win a round. You obviously have to land punches, but you could win a fight through defense or win rounds through defense. And I think sometimes that just gets overlooked.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. And I think that judging, just kind of piggyback off of what you just mentioned right now, like we want them to do it perfect. I think their job and a surgeon are the only ones in the world that have to do a perfect job. You know, we don't want to see, there's no room for error for these judges. But I agree with you. The way they sit sometimes, and some of these judges, I've seen them where they're really kind of crouching their head and looking, you know, underneath the ropes, or the ref is in their way. Yeah. So it does give, and that's why I wonder when Montoya had said this to me one time, and I was like, that's not a bad idea, because we're so critical of how they see a fight that we don't even get a chance to see if they really do have a good angle. What exactly are they seeing? My other question always been is that they should they not be like a age limit or go back to a refresh course to see whether or not their eyes are well enough? Are they responding back? Are they seeing exactly what's in front of them? You know, I always think that we can, you know, perfect example. If you're in the union and you're a welder, it's every 3 years or so. I could be wrong about this. Every 3 years or so, you have to go back and retest. I think that's what judges need to do as well. What do you think?
I think that, you know, one thing that they don't talk about a lot, but most real commissions, the good commissions, they do have judging seminars that they require judges to go to. And then they have to take physicals to make sure that they are fit. And one thing I think that's dangerous is the ageism aspect, in the sense that just because a judge is old means that he can't do the job anymore, which is not necessarily true. Because a judge like Dave Moretti is a good example. I believe Dave Moretti is 75 or 76 years old. And he looks at, when you see him, he looks like he's 75 or 76 years old.
Right.
But he's a very good judge. He's one of the best judges in the world, which is why he continually gets those types of assignments from the Nevada Commission. Steve Weisfeld, who's from here in New Jersey, he's an attorney from New Jersey, is in his 50s. I think one of the best, I've always thought that he's one of the best judges in boxing. So he's not older, but I just think that sometimes, I think with anything, I mean, you can't be 90 years old judging fights, I don't think.
Yeah. Some guys are a bit different, because I've met guys that are like 75 and they're sharp. They're still sharp, you know, in the car business that I'm in the industry, even when I was a union plumber, I've met guys in their 70s, even like breaking into the 80s, and they're sharp still. You know, they're much sharper than guys that are 20, 25. But then you meet some folks that are in that age range that it's you could totally tell their age, you know, and their life has finally caught up to them and whatever they've kind of lived, you know, if it's been a healthy life or not. But you could see that it's finally caught up. And I think that's my concern with some judges is, you know, we got to know how well they're able to respond to certain things that are on the fly. Because in boxing, you're watching the action live. You're seeing this live. It's not like you're seeing a delayed, program or not. You're there physically. And, you know, the noise and, you know, all the stuff that's going around, I wonder how much of that is a distraction for some of these guys that are in these 70 and up range.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, Dave, I think you'd have to look at the judge's track record, like at whether the judge is 54 or 84. I think, you know, look at how the judge is scoring the fights in comparison to the other judges, or how maybe, you know, the commissioner himself might have scored the fight. I think that's important. You know, if there's a history and a recent track record of a judge getting it wrong, and the judge is older, you know, maybe the judge shouldn't be licensed anymore. But I think the same principles apply if you're 45, or, you know, if you're 40, if you're bad at it, you shouldn't be licensed to do it anymore. And there are unfortunately some judges. Look, there's a judge who, after she, you know, she CJ Ross in Nevada. I don't mean to pick on her. I don't know her personally, but she, you know, the score that she had for the Timothy Bradley Manny Pacquiao fight was unacceptable.
Oh, God.
And then she scored the Canelo Alvarez Floyd Mayweather fight a draw, and, you know, Floyd Mayweather won 9 or 10 rounds of that fight,
right?
And she scored the draw. So after that, she was never licensed to judge another fight again. You can't keep giving someone high profile assignments that affect fights that are worth tens and tens of millions of dollars if they can't get it right. So she's the primary example that I can remember in recent years where they just said, look, I don't think it was an age thing with her. I don't know exactly how old she was in 2013 when she judged the Canelo Mayweather fight, but she wasn't Dave Moretti's age. And they just said, hey, look, that's it. I mean, she never judged another boxing match. That was the last one. So, so I think, you know, when things are egregious and you need to sit someone down, you sit them down. That's it.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes boxing gets it right. And this was one of them, you know? So, this past week, we had an actual boxing schedule, an event that happened in Nicaragua, and I believe it was South Korea. Is this where we're at? I mean, did you have a chance to watch that event, those events, first off, Keith?
Some of the Nicaragua event. I mean, it was basically a club card, but at this point,
right?
We'll take any boxing we can get, I guess. Yeah. And I mean, you know, at least it was boxing, right? It's some indication that we'll get there. We don't know how long that's going to be in the United States or the UK and places like that, but it was something, and we'll take anything at this point, right? I mean, we're watching,
right?
You know, we're watching. They're getting great ratings for fights that happened 20 years ago on TV.
No, so, man, I know. You know, so do we see like Top Rank, Golden Boy, or any of these guys follow suit? I mean, that whole Nicaragua card, the face mask, there was a very light amount of audience in the crowd and all that, wearing face masks and stuff. But the fighters obviously couldn't wear the face mask. They're engaging, trying to knock each other's heads off. Do you see this following suit? You know, do you see the U.S. saying, okay, these guys did it. We're going to have to try to do the same thing. You know, do you see it happening in maybe Florida, or anything? Like, is Nevada, are you hearing anything about this right now?
They will try it. It is going to happen. They will have shows behind closed doors in Nevada, California, probably later than Nevada, just based on the things that, the governor of your state has said. I don't think they'll be first by any stretch, but, I spoke to Bob Arum on Friday, and he told me that that they were looking at Nevada, Texas, and California primarily at doing these studio shows. Those were the three states. They have good relationships with those commissions, and they were comfortable with them. He said for the time being they would not go to Florida, that they weren't looking to do that. He's hoping that the UFC events in May go off well and no one gets sick or anything, but there's some trepidation. I mean, he thinks maybe it's a little too soon to be doing that. And I don't think, to answer your question, Dave, I don't think we'll see those studio shows in the United States until late June, probably at the earliest. I don't think it's going to be any time in May or in the beginning of June. I think they're going to let some of these numbers go down a little bit, and before anyone's going to be willing to take the risk, frankly, even if there's aren't any fans in the building and there are only 50 to 100 people allowed in the venue, they're going to have to be very, very careful and make sure that everyone, and that means everyone, is tested before the show goes forward.
Right. You know, I mean, Dana White, in an interview, I believe it was with Kevin Ioli, he mentioned that they're going to spend a lot of money. They're spending a lot of money in this Florida thing. I'm pretty sure that the medical staff is going to be amped up in terms of costs, because I've said this on my show. The one thing that stands out for me and anybody trying to do a in-studio event in the sport, in any combat sport or any sport across the board, is the medical staff. Because it's got to be slim right now. My wife works in the medical field. She works at the hospital. So everybody is required to be there first because that's priority first to treat anybody that has coronavirus or testing or anything that comes along that line. So I'm thinking that that's where the most cost is going to come out of pocket for these promoters is the medical staffing. I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to make sure that their bases are covered 1,000% because there's a lot of liability. It's, if you promote a show and someone catches coronavirus at your show, I mean, there are going to be all kinds of waivers that are going to be signed beforehand and everything. And I'm sure they're going to do everything they can to make sure people are safe. But if someone, God forbid, gets sick, and that's what Bob Arum was stressing to me the other day. He said, look, this sucks for all of us. The promoters want to make money. Everyone involved in boxing wants to go about their business and do their jobs again, but we have to be smart about it, and we can't just jump in just because we're tired of waiting. He said you have to do the responsible thing and the sensible thing and realize that in the grand scheme of all of this, boxing is irrelevant. And, while it's my livelihood and it's a big part of yours, Dave, it's irrelevant in the grand scheme of it all, right? So we just have to be patient. And whether those fights happen in June, July, or whenever, we just have to wait it out.
I mean, because I can't wrap my brain about how they're going to do it. Look, you can have a control area in the studio, but outside that studio, thinking about boarding the fighters, the staff, everybody that's going to be involved in the card, talking about the UFC, how do you have a controlled area where you're going to board everybody? How are you going to have a controlled area in airports, the flights? As I saw today in the news, there's people still getting on airplanes, which is a confined space, not wearing masks, not there's no disinfection, not wearing gloves. So I wonder, did they take any of that accountable, especially Dana White and the UFC? Have they taken that accountable? Is that part of the budget they're talking about that's going to cost them a lot of money because they're going to have to really, fine comb everything they're going to do before these fighters step into that cage, right?
Yeah, and then what about the people who are asymptomatic and might not test positive for it when they're actually tested? Now, there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, there's no way around that, but there are just so many factors involved, Dave. And like you said, you don't know who's being careful and who's not. I mean, you see people doing all kinds of crazy things every day. And I'm sure your wife can attest to this in how people wind up in the hospital. And were they being cautious or were they just unlucky in the wrong place at the wrong time? Who knows? But you see a lot of people still just not adhering to what they're supposed to be doing. And you're just like, what are you crazy? Like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
But people are still doing it.
So is boxing being smart enough? Bob Arum, let's talk about Bob Arum a bit here. Is he being smart enough right now to hold back and witness for the first guy to do the event, which is going to be Dana White? I personally think that's the smartest thing to do is to wait, look at what the other guy's doing first, and then you can piggyback and make corrections. That's what Dana White did with boxing. He looked at the model and said, okay, here's where I could fix it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they are just waiting. They're letting someone else try it out and find out. And he has said that. Bob in particular has said that. He said, look, let's see what the major sports leagues do. Let's see what the NBA does. I don't know if the NHL season will pick up again, but the NBA or Major League Baseball, which is formulating these plans to have a season in Arizona and whatever else they're doing. So he's going to take his cue from other sports, and he's not looking to be first, I guess, is to answer your question, Dave. But he's not looking to be first and try these things out and have it go south, but Bob is a smart, the other thing is you mentioning earlier about older people being sharp. Bob Arum's 88 years old. And he doesn't get around great anymore. I see him in person quite often and everything. He doesn't move around as well as he once did or anything, but he's almost 90 years old. But his mind is very sharp. I mean, you wouldn't know that he's 88 years old when you talk to him, which is why we all still talk to him with the regularity that we do, because he's the same as he was 15 years ago or whenever he's first talking to him,
I've always wanted to ask Bob, man, do you sleep with your money, Bob? I got to know, do you sleep with that money? Everything that keeps you going, Keith, you ever have a chance, ask him that question for me and let me know, man. Text me and tell me because if that's the way I can live to be 88, almost his age, and still be that sharp is I have to sleep with my money. I'm going to do it, bro. I'm going to do whatever it takes.
Dave, I hear you. You know, the thing that's interesting about Bob too is, you know, he wasn't born into money. He's not from wealth. You know, he built it. He took a risk, you know, being a former, you know, government attorney and a tax division and everything. And he the whole story, how he came together with Muhammad Ali and everything. And he made himself wealthy. And the other interesting thing about Bob is, look, people have their faults with him. I understand all that and everything. Right. But when have you ever heard a fighter say that Bob Arum stole money from them? Even the fighters that he didn't get along with, the fighters that disassociated themselves with Bob, Floyd Mayweather, Oscar De La Hoya. You know, Floyd just had a different opinion of where his career could go, you know, from in terms of tapping into the urban market, and he thought he could be a bigger star. And Bob even says, yeah, he was right. Floyd was right, and I was wrong, and we didn't figure out a way to do it. And Floyd became the biggest star in the financially anyway, in the history of the sport. You know, Oscar, they had differences of opinion and everything, but they never said that Bob stole money from them. And there are a lot of promoters, and I mean a lot.
Right.
That fighters say that about.
Well, his yang would be Don King, you know? And I think that his nemesis, Don King, at that time, we're talking about, you know, Muhammad Ali, and George Foreman and all that, of that great era of heavyweights, is I think promoters need the yang of another promoter to make them that sharp, make them that better. And I think that Bob has that up on a lot of these guys, like from Golden Boy, and even like Al Haymon at the moment. It doesn't force them. In my opinion, it doesn't force them sometimes to give us the best fights because they don't have the yang. Top Rank, Bob, as we've known, he can be a bit frustrating. He doesn't like to get his fighters involved in the tournaments, doesn't like to, if he can keep it in-house, he's going to do it as long as he can, you know, and that could be a bit frustrating. But like I said, it doesn't seem like the other promoters are forcing him to play along the way Don King used to do back in that time.
You're right, Dave. And I think maybe one of the interesting things that could come out of this, or one of the benefits for boxing fans that could come out of this pandemic, is that maybe they will make some of these bigger fights faster because they won't want to pay for tune-up fights. Now, the flip side, of course, is you're not going to come out of this pandemic in the economic situation that we're in and start charging people $80 for pay-per-view fights every other month. So I guess maybe, you know, there's a flip side to it, I guess. But
let's hope.
But I think maybe we'll see some of the fights that we thought might take longer to make. Maybe we'll see some of those fights sooner, which, you know, we'd be all for that, right?
I definitely, you know what? And I hope that folks, when this comes back, you know, when it starts opening up the doors, I hope folks are more appreciative of the sport, you know? Whereas before, when Sean Porter and Errol Spence Jr., when that was announced originally and went on pay-per-view, how many people bagged on that fight? And it turned out to be a great, great, great fight. Which leads me to the next topic I wanted to talk to you about here. An article that you wrote, because you had a chance to interview Sean Porter on the boxing scene. Porter saying, taking some shots fired at Errol Spence, saying that he believes Terrence Crawford can beat him. Do you think there's a motive there, Keith? Did you get like a motive off of him, meaning that he's probably looking to get underneath the skin of Errol Spence to possibly get that rematch that a lot of us were hoping that was going to happen first?
Yeah, the story was actually written off a Facebook Live interview, Dave, that he did, I believe it was about a week ago now. But he did like a very lengthy Facebook Live interaction on the PBC Facebook page with fans. I think some of it has to do with him getting under Errol Spence's skin because there's an obvious rivalry between those guys. I think they respect each other, but they take little shots at each other here and there where you could tell they want to get a dig in at the other guy. But I think there's a healthy respect there after that fight. It was a great, great fight. I mean, unfortunately for them, I thought on the night of September 28th, I said, man, this is going to be like a real candidate for fight of the year this year. It was that good of a fight. And then Derevianchenko and Golovkin fought the following Saturday. I said, well, maybe not, you know.
Right.
But it was a great action fight. You know, the interesting thing too, Dave, is I think that oftentimes, as you know, when we get the fighters at the highest level, they're so good and they're so respectful of one another. and there's so little separating them that we don't get the great action fights out of those fights that we typically would want. And that was an exception, because to some degree, Spence fought Porter's fight and engaged in that dogfight that Sean Porter needed it to be as close as it was. I thought Spence won also, but I don't think he won going away. I think he won 7-5, and then he had the knockdown. So I thought Steve Weisfeld and I think Ray Dinesco was the other judge that had, they think that's how they had it, 115-112, and then Larry Hazard Jr. had it 115-112 the other way for Porter. I don't think you could make the argument that Porter won 8 rounds of that fight.
Right.
It was a very, very competitive fight. And I'd love to, there are other fights we want to see. Obviously, we want to see Crawford fight Spence, but I'd love to see Porter fight Spence again. And just for your, to answer your question too, Dave, I think, Porter is very friendly with Crawford. That wasn't advertised all that much over the last couple of years, but they are actually pretty friendly.
Right.
So part of it maybe is that he's just, he sees it in a, and he actually said that too. He said, maybe I'm a little biased because Terrence and I are friends, but I think Terrence will win.
I know. I mean, I was so disappointed when Terrence was like, that fight, doesn't make any sense for me. Doesn't do nothing for me facing Porter. And now I was like, what? Come on, man. That's a great fight. The thing about Porter is that there's not a whole lot of fighters that possess that style that makes the other opponent commit to into trading with their style. You got to be, fairly disciplined, like Kell Brook. Kell Brook was able to continue to fight his style. He never got suckered into fighting Porter style, which is up in close and allow Porter to come forward and maul you up, But it's kind of hard, man. When you get a guy that's like a mini bull that just keeps coming forward nonstop, and if you don't have a jab, which Errol Spence displayed, he had a phenomenal jab against Mikey Garcia. But my question was, when the fight was announced and we had to do our breakdown, was could Errol Spence, establish a stiff jab to a full-size 147 welterweight? And I doubted it. I didn't think he was going to be able to do that because Mikey Garcia is a much, much smaller guy. And style-wise, Mikey Garcia doesn't fight like Sean Porter.
Yeah, Errol Spence boxed beautifully against Mikey Garcia. And I think he did it to prove a point because people were saying that, Mikey was the textbook boxer and Errol wasn't as good of a boxer, so he outboxed him. But his version of it is that he purposely fought Sean Porter's fight to show that he could win that type of dogfight. Now, I don't know if that's true, because it could be that Sean Porter made him fight that type of fight, because oftentimes he makes everyone fight. He does. Ugas was another guy who was able to box, I thought, against Porter, and he did very well, and there are a lot of people who think Ugas deserved to win that fight.
Yeah.
But typically when Porter makes you fight the way that he's comfortable, it's a very close fight, right? And he's fought everyone except for Crawford, really. He's fought, he fought Keith Thurman, he fought Danny Garcia, he fought Errol Spence, he fought Kell Brook. I mean, who hasn't he fought except Terrence Crawford? And to speak to that, Dave, I value what Terrence Crawford has done. And I've been a person who have said I've had him at the top of my pound for pound list. I see the arguments for Lomachenko. I see the arguments for an emerging Canelo. And I have counter arguments for those. So I've had Crawford at the top of my list, but I mean, if you have him 1, 2, or 3, you can't not get the PBC fights that you want. And then when one presents itself, say, well, I don't want to do it because we're friends.
I know.
And Sean Porter has said that they're friends also, but if the money's right, and it's a fight I think people would more – if you said to people a year ago, I want to see Terrence Crawford fight Sean Porter, so people would be interested in the fight, but I don't think there would have been as much interest as there is now based on what he did against Errol Spence. You still want to see him fight Spence more, but I think Porter-Crawford now is a bigger fight and a fight more people would want to see than it was this time a year ago.
I think you're right. I mean, I have to agree with you because here one is that Porter gave – a back and forth with Errol Spence Jr., who is considerably everybody's top welterweight champion, right? And Crawford, I think what goes off with Crawford now is his semi-war that he had with the Mean Machine, And I think that immediately after him saying, it's a meaningless fight for me to face Showtime Sean Porter – it's got to knock you down a few notches on anybody's list as top, you know, top fighters in any division. Because that's exactly how I felt. I was like, okay, then who else? Because it's got to be one of these guys. And Sean Porter would have been that guy to kind of keep you there in the top one, two, or three spots. Not facing him or facing anybody else. You know, if you're facing another, like, rated 10 or 15 or 20, to me, it just keeps knocking you down, your value of where you're at in your career. What do you think?
Well, I think he's going to fight Kell Brook next, and I don't think that's going to make a lot of people all that happy. But, you know, but Kell Brook did beat – it was a long time ago now. It was 5.5 years ago, but he did beat Sean Porter. You know, a lot of things have happened to Kell Brook negatively since – you know, he had his face broken apart twice in back-to-back fights against Golovkin and Spence. But – and he's not really a welterweight anymore. He's going to have to struggle to get down to the welterweight limit, assuming they fight at 147 pounds. But I think that is going to be his next fight. And again, I think people are going to pick that apart, and to some degree, rightfully so. Because if you had any opportunity to make the fight with Sean Porter, that's a fight people want to see much more. Or I think more people would want to see him move up to 154, even though Terrence Crawford would be a very small junior middleweight.
Yeah.
I think rather see him do that and fight Patrick Teixeira than they would see him fight Kell Brook at welterweight, because what does that really prove?
You know, I tell you what, I wouldn't want to see him to go to 154, because it'd be like a remembrance of when Ike Corte did it, you know, moved to 154, but he was more dominant at 147, you know, mm-hmm. but Ike did it for all different reasons, money, and couldn't get that rematch with Oscar De La Hoya and whatnot, or Shane Mosley. But the same thing with Crawford. I mean, it's unfinished business at 147, you know, and I'd like to see him be a bit more aggressive in getting these PBC fights as he is on Twitter. You know, we see that I've said this, you know, he's more lively on Twitter than he is in an actual interview, you know, in front of a camera, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the one thing I will say is Terrence Crawford is a dog in the ring. And by that, I don't mean in a negative way. I mean, when it's time to bite down, Dave, as you well know, like when he got hurt against Kavalauskas, and despite what he says, he was hurt,
right.
You know, and it probably should have counted as a knockdown. I believe it was in the third round, but he came back and knocked out a guy who can really punch.
Right.
You know, Kavalauskas struggled with Ray Robinson in his previous fight. There are people thought that maybe he lost that fight, but Kavalauskas is a very physically strong guy, and he can punch. So it wasn't an easy fight. So I think in some respects, while I agree with you, I want to see Crawford fight the top welterweights also. I don't think he gets the credit probably that he deserves. Now, the Amir Khan fight, I understand why people, you know, Amir Khan is a star, but he's not a top welterweight. So what was the point of that was just to try to get him in there and get a good win against a recognizable name. But, you know, and Jose Benavidez, people say, oh, well, he was, you know, he's hobbling around on one leg, which to some extent was true. But no one had beaten Jose Benavidez before that. Right. And he was a much bigger guy than Crawford. And then the Jeff Horn fight. You know, Jeff Horn, I don't think he beat Pacquiao. I thought Pacquiao deserved to win that fight.
He gave everything to handle, you know, all he can handle that night with Manny, I thought.
Right. And Dave, he's a rough dude to fight.
Yep.
And Terrence Crawford went in there and beat the crap out of him. I mean, it wasn't even remotely competitive. So
no.
I'm not saying Jeff Horn is Errol Spence by any stretch of the imagination, but
right.
It almost seems to me like he doesn't get credit. No matter what he does, he doesn't get credit for it. And in some ways, he won't. Until he fights Errol Spence or even Sean Porter
or
even
Danny Garcia, you know,
those guys.
Yeah, you know, I mean, those are names that it must be frustrating on his part where he's the, you know, when they talk about streets, you know, well, he's got to cross the street. It must be rough, man, when you're the lonely guy across the street and you're watching everybody having a fiesta, you know, on the other side. I'm just like, man. But let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about Leo Santa Cruz. Leo Santa Cruz saying, hey, I got options. If I don't get Gervonta Tank Davis, I can go after Gary Russell Jr. In your opinion, man, what out of the two names right there that he's mentioning, which one do you really would want to see Leo Santa Cruz go after first?
I would prefer to see him fight Gary Russell. They're around the same age and they're closer in weight. Not that Tank is a huge guy by any stretch, but he's a lightweight now. So I would prefer to see him fight Gary Russell because that's a fight we've wanted to see for several years. It really depends, Dave, on who you listen to. Some people say that it's Gary Russell doesn't really want the fight, which doesn't make any sense to me because right. I think Gary Russell is a much more talented fighter. It's not going out on a limb by any stretch, but you know, I think he's a more talented guy than Leo. Leo is a very tough guy, a volume puncher who's a very tough out for anyone, but I think Gary Russell would beat him. So maybe it's that the fight is too expensive for both guys. You know, what both guys are asking for is just too much in terms of what they would get back on that investment for that fight to ever happen. But if I had my choice and finances weren't involved, I would prefer to see Gary Russell fight Leo Santa Cruz. And the other thing is, you know, I think Gervonta Davis would knock out Leo Santa Cruz.
I think so too.
But if you make, Dave, if you make the fight at 130, you're asking for a fiasco at the weigh-in. Because Gervonta Davis moved up 5 pounds in his last fight. I was there in Atlanta at the weigh-in. And he came in a pound and a half overweight for a lightweight fight.
Right.
Now you have Leo Santa Cruz saying, in the beginning, Leo was saying, I'll go up to 35 even because he has just fought at 130 one time now against Miguel Flores. But he said, I'll go up to 135 just for the opportunity to get the fight because I think Leo knows it's a huge fight, a good pay-per-view fight. He'll make a lot of money, maybe more money than he would make for fighting Gary Russell. So I think he was willing to do it. But I think the more that Leo thought about it, I think he realized, hey, I'm giving up every advantage I have.
Every advantage, right.
Go up 35. You know?
Yeah, because you know what? Even though you're a volume puncher, for one, you don't know how your body's going to react to throwing that volume anymore. For two, he's not a big puncher. He's more of a guy that kind of just wears you down. And so how effective is his punching going to be at that weight? You know, there's only a few fighters that have left a particular weight move up. Comes to mind right away is Tito Trinidad that carries their power with them moving up in weight. I don't see a Leo Santa Cruz doing that. And it's definitely all the advantages got to go with Tank Davis, you know. And you're right. I personally, I'm glad that he rethought that because not only is it's, I mean, I know Davis has got a good size amount of fans in his hometown, but Santa Cruz has a country that comes right behind him. So that's got to count for something, right?
Yeah, and he's very popular in Southern California. I think that's where the fight would be, honestly. I don't think it would be in, you know, the Baltimore, D.C. area or anything like that, or Atlanta, where Tank just did a pretty good crowd there for the Gamboa fight. I think it would be at Staples Center or somewhere like that in L.A. And I think they would do a good crowd there because Leo's a pretty popular guy. I'm not saying he's a mainstream star or anything, but he's a pretty popular fighter based on his style. He's a very likable person. I mean, you're not going to meet nicer guys than Leo Santa Cruz, obviously. But and I'm not saying it wouldn't be an entertaining fight because Leo's going to keep coming forward. But I just think Gervonta Davis is just too big of a puncher for him. And I think he would get him out of there at some point. So I would rather see him fight Russell. And, you know, again, that's a fight we've been talking about for 3 or 4 years. And it doesn't really seem like we're any closer to it happening.
Oh, I know, man. I know. You know, Gary Russell Jr., I bet you he's loving this quarantine because now he doesn't have to make up excuses of why he's not getting back into the ring. Almost like Keith Thurman, right?
Hey, I'll say this. Hey, this has been a bonanza of activity for Gary Russell. He fought in May and he fought in February. So, you know, he's fought more than Leo has in the last year or so, right? I mean, it's
and who would have thought that, right?
That's not normally what he does, but but yeah, so, and I think Russell realizes the one thing I'll say about Gary Russell that I've been told, he's never said this to me, but that his hands are, now all fighters have problems with their hands because it's not normal to do this with your hands, but he has abnormal problems with his hands for fighters, I would say. So he doesn't really advertise that much, but part of it is that his hands are brittle. That doesn't help his cause in terms of his activity.
Hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a big thing with fighters, you know, all the little bones that you got in your hands, they don't heal up, you know, once you break them. It takes a long time, and any little thing, after that, when you break your hand, any little thing, you know, can actually give you another swelling and stuff like that. So, no, I definitely, you know, well, you always want your fighters to be healthy and ready to go. Let's talk a little bit about Canelo Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez 3. There's been talks about it happening in September. How realistic do you see it, Keith? Do you really think that's going to happen in September? And you know, there's been reports that they may go off and have a tune-up fight. Well, actually, Gennady Golovkin mentioning that, his team and himself mentioning they want another fight before getting in with Canelo Alvarez.
I don't know if September is realistic based on how long this pandemic is going now, Dave. I don't really know. You know, because if you can't have a large crowd, if you're not allowed to have a large gathering, then you can't do a fight like that because you need the gate money to help satisfy the purses. So they can't do it in an empty arena or in a studio setting or anything. It's way too big of a fight for that. It would be too costly for the promoters. So maybe it goes to October, November, maybe even December. What I do know, and I wrote a column for the site the other day, and I'm not picking on Gennady Golovkin. I mean, he's been a credit to the sport, you know, has a fan base and everything. He's been a fantastic middleweight champion. But he wants a tune-up fight against Kamil. It's a mandatory fight. He's right. The IBF champion. Kamil Zarameta is the number three ranked contender. So it's not like it's not like it's some absurdly overdue mandatory like Dillian White with the WBC or something like that. But he is his mandatory challenger. He's the next available challenger. And they had an agreement to fight on, it was going to be on June 6th. I mean, there was some flexibility there on when it might've been, but he still wants to go forward with that fight. I just don't know how realistic that is based on what the economy is going to be like when we come back from this. Now, he does have a six-fight contract with the Zone, and that's the other part that I don't understand. From Golovkin's perspective, he has done nothing but say that he has not varied from this stance, that he wants to fight Canelo Alvarez.
Right.
Whenever Canelo is ready, whenever he's willing, he will fight him. Now, I'm not advocating the way Canelo Alvarez went about it, but now he said, and whether Golovkin likes it or not, Canelo's the A-side.
Right.
So he's now said, I'm ready to fight. I'll fight him next. I won't have to fight Billy Joe Saunders first. If this is the fight that DAZN wants because they need a big fight to come back with, to satisfy their subscribers, to generate new subscriptions, I'm willing to do it.
Right.
It's very difficult to hear Gennady Golovkin turn around and say, well, I have to fight Zarameta first.
But you can't blame him though, right? I mean, look, it's a smart move because he's been inactive. He's got to get himself. I think if anybody in his team, his management could see, like, look, it's probably best that we get him in there, shake off any ring rust because we want to make sure that he's fully ready to go against Canelo. But at the same time, he's actually stepping on his own tongue because he's been chasing Canelo from the beginning, from the start, you know, and his fan base as well, saying that, you know, hey, Canelo is just trying to draw him out to get old and you know, wait him out and stuff, and then he can knock him out much easier. Now they can't really use that excuse anymore because now it's the fighter that's saying, hey, let's pump our brakes. You know, when I said I wanted to fight you right away, what I really meant was let me first get myself, you know, all conditioned and ready to go in a third rubber match, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's going to take a lot of criticism for that, Dave. And the other thing is to look at it from DAZN's perspective. They've committed to six fights for Gennady Golovkin. No questions asked. I mean, he could get knocked out, and I don't think this would happen, but just for argument's sake, say he got knocked out in the fifth or sixth round by Canelo. Well, right. DAZN would still owe him three fights at a very healthy sum of money per fight. So there's no real risk involved in that sense. I mean, it's not going to affect his financial future if he goes into the fight against Canelo and loses, you know, whether it's by a wide decision or a TKO or whatever. The other thing is they don't want to pay him $15 million in effect, which is what it would be, to fight Kamil Zarameta. They would have done it before under what was going on before this coronavirus pandemic started, because Canelo at that point had not committed. You know, he was in negotiations to fight Saunders or Smith, and he had agreed to fight him after that. So I understand, you know, at that point, Golovkin wanted to stay busy. He wanted to get his mandatory out of the way because he doesn't want to get stripped. But ultimately, if it comes down to him getting stripped or taking the Canelo fight, from DAZN's perspective, they don't care about the IBF middleweight title. It brings no more value to that fight than that.
Right.
People want to see Canelo and Triple G fight again. It doesn't matter if it's for the IBF title or the WBC or no title whatsoever. That's irrelevant. And so it almost looks to me like what is Golovkin trying to do? Like, while I understand they want to get some rounds in against Zarameta,
right,
how many rounds is he going to get in? The guy's 21-0 with four knockouts and has literally beaten no one at the top level. how many rounds is he going to last with Gennady Golovkin? So just for argument's sake, say he went six rounds. Is that going to make a dramatic difference for when he – I'm not saying activity doesn't help, but is that fight really going to help him? And the other thing is, Dave, they will have been out almost the same amount of time because Golovkin fought Derevyanchenko on October 5th, and Canelo fought Sergey Kovalev on November 2nd, 4 weeks later. So it's not like he has some sort of big advantage over Golovkin because he's been much more active in the short term. He hasn't.
You know, the only thing I can come up with of their reasoning of wanting to go to their mandatory and hold off against getting back in with Canelo Alvarez, Keith, is that they want to wash any memory of the Derevyanchenko fight. I think that they feel if we can get another KO reel, we can get the attraction that they believe they deserve in this rubber match. Because the sense that I'm getting from the fans, a lot of fans, especially my listeners, have all emailed me or have called into the show saying, I don't care to see Canelo Gennady Golovkin 3, which puzzled me because I do care to see it. I thought that both fights were phenomenal. I thought both fights were very, very competitive. And I'm still one of those hopeful fans that believe that we haven't seen the last of Gennady Golovkin, meaning that he hasn't got old, as a lot of folks have suggested. But I just get this sense that that's what they want to do, is wash any memory of the Derevyanchenko fight, because it really did hurt their stock, in my opinion. It really affected them in terms of being more aggressive on the negotiation table, because this is something Golden Boy and Canelo obviously have looked into and said, hey, we're the A side. Look at the way your guy looked. You know, he looks like he's out the door. You're going to have to take the crumbs that we're going to give you.
Yeah, he's going, Dave, he's going to make an enormous amount of money for this third fight, meaning right. Golovkin, he'll make a huge, I mean, close to double what he would make from fighting Zerometa or anyone else. So he's going to be paid very handsomely. I understand what you're saying, that, you know, maybe the brand was impacted a little bit against Derevyanchenko, but you could personally, while I do want to see Canelo Golovkin fight one more time, because although Canelo won the last fight, I thought it was a close fight. I thought Canelo won also, but it was a close enough fight where you'd want to see it a third time, right. Even though he's advanced in age since the second fight. But have you ever been more satisfied? And I mean ever, in all of the times that you saw Gennady Golovkin fight, have you ever been more satisfied with what you saw than when you saw him fight Sergey Derevyanchenko? It's the most entertaining fight he's ever been in.
It was a great fight.
And it's not close.
Yeah.
It's not close.
Yep. Yeah. No, I agree with you.
So in my opinion, I understand, you know, the money is not the same, of course. Right. You know, there are different stratospheres in terms of the finances. But I would rather see Derevyanchenko Golovkin 2 than I would rather see Canelo Golovkin 3. It's not as nearly as big of a fight, obviously. But from a pure action standpoint, I would sign me up for round 13 of that.
As a boxing ghoul that you are, like me, that is a fight that I love to see. Because in my opinion, if you want to wash the memory of what happened in that first fight, you do it in a rematch. Because, you know, the what was reported after was that Gennady Golovkin was sick. He had a cold. Okay, do the rematch. Let's see if he looks any different, any better. Let's see if there's any truth to that we could hold to. That's a fight that definitely was asking for immediately after when that fight happened. But obviously, like you said, the money-wise is what they're chasing, what they've been asking for quite some time. But I agree with you all the way. The rematch with Derevyanchenko makes a lot of sense, you know, in terms of trying to wash any memory of the first fight.
Yeah, the thing, and the reason they won't do it, Dave, is because it's such a dangerous fight. And I understand that. I mean, we don't know yet how much that fight took out of Gennady Golovkin overall, because he hasn't fought since then. And he shouldn't have fought since then. That was a brutal fight. You know, you take six, 8 months, whatever it is. I mean, you shouldn't fight right away after that. But that was a brutal fight. So I think they kind of looked at it like, okay, we don't want to see that guy again. But if you're DAZN and you're paying him all this money, and at that point, Canelo had not committed to fighting him a third time, and he was balking at fighting Derevyanchenko again. So now what? You won't fight Derevyanchenko. Canelo won't fight you. Mm-hmm. They're not going to keep paying him $15 million to fight. If you look at it, if he gets what he wants out of this, DAZN will have paid him a lot of money, probably close to $30 million, for two fights against Steve Rolls and Camille Zaremeta.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever they paid him for the Derevianchenko fight, they should slide him a little, you know, more, because he more than earned it in that fight, and so did Derevianchenko. But the other two fights, they really haven't gotten much value for their money, and that's, you're halfway through the contract, and he still hasn't fought Canelo, and you're paying him eight. Now, some people would say, well, that's DAZN's fault. I mean, that they're the ones who made this deal, so they have to live with the consequences of it, which I understand to some degree also.
You know, it makes me wonder, because, you know, Derevianchenko was originally was the name that was brought up for the May 5th fight, or Cinco de Mayo fight, where the rematch with Canelo, but instead they opted to go after Mataroshian. Remember that there? So they paid step-aside money to Derevianchenko. So obviously they knew something about Derevianchenko, which a lot of folks already told me, that like, this kid's brutal. This kid's ruthless, you know. He's going to be hard to handle, you know. So they knew something then, and then they finally took this fight. And again, can't blame them by saying that's a dangerous fight. We already tested that water, and it was almost too deep for us. We almost drowned.
Yeah, you're right, Dave. And he knew Derevianchenko from the amateurs. He knew, you know, he didn't have a lot of professional fights, and his career took off pretty slowly as a professional. But Golovkin knew what he was dealing with. He even said so in the press conference and in the build-up to the fight. He knew that was not – I don't know that he necessarily expected that.
Right.
But he was not going to be an easy fight, and it sure wasn't.
No, it wasn't, man. It was a back-and-forth war between those two. Let's go on to our next topic here really quick, if I can find it. I'm going blind, man. I got my glasses. I'm still blind here. Okay, so the quarantine, the self-in-place shelter. Let me ask you, Keith, what fighters do you think have benefited from this and have not benefited from a quarantine self-shelter in placement?
Well, you know, any fighter who's injured, I think, benefited from it. Like, a good example would be Devin Haney. You know, Devin Haney, he had shoulder surgery in December.
Right.
And he was made the champion in recess by the WBC. And then Javier Fortuna was going to fight Luke Campbell for the interim title. I think it was the regular title, because he was the champion in recess. And then the winner would have had to have fought Devin Haney. So now, because nothing can happen for 3 or 4 months, Devin Haney has been reinstituted as the champion. And he's going to have to make his mandatory defense against Javier Fortuna. Now, Luke Campbell says, I should still get my title shot. And I understand what he's saying. I mean, the coronavirus isn't Luke Campbell's fault, obviously. So I get where he's coming from a business perspective. But on the other side of it, you know, Luke Campbell just got his title shot against Lomachenko. And, you know, he lost probably 9 rounds of the fight. And that fight just happened late in August. So I think Haney is probably the guy that might have benefited the most from it in that respect, because he'll get to make his mandatory, keep his title, and then, you know, in his first fight back from this, I think. In terms of who's been hurt by it, you'd have to say Billy Joe Saunders, right? I mean, Billy Joe Saunders was supposed to make a lot of money to fight this Saturday night against Canelo Alvarez, and now it looks like when Canelo comes back, he's probably going to fight Golovkin if they can convince Golovkin to do it. Now, maybe Billy Joe Saunders still gets the fight if Canelo Golovkin 3 doesn't come together for September, October, November, right, or whatever. But I'd say Saunders probably has been hurt by it the most financially, for sure.
You know, I was reading a report about Deontay Wilder, that he had an operation in his right hand again, right? I was thinking, like, wait a minute, you're telling me he was going to go into a rubber match with Tyson Fury with an injured hand, you know, and what was it, supposed to be set in June, or was it July?
It was July 18th, but it was actually his left arm, Dave. He tore his jab arm, his left biceps. He's had surgery on his right biceps before.
Right.
And obviously his right hand is like a Frankenstein hand, basically, at this point, right, put together multiple different times with multiple surgeries. He's had a broken arm. He's had all kinds of injuries to his right arm, but this was actually his left arm. He said he was on the PBC podcast about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, and he said that he had been given clearance to start doing boxing training from somewhere between mid-May to late May. So if they would have fought on July 18th, yeah, he would have been pushing it for sure.
Yeah.
But he might have done it because there was so much money at stake, and contractually they had to give him the third fight by July 18th, I think was what was in the contract, which is why it was that date. I think they're all – no one's happy that the pandemic is happening, but I think they're all happy to some degree that the fight was pushed back. It's tentatively scheduled for October 3rd now. Again, who knows, because that's another one of those fights. You can't have it without the crowd.
Right. It just raises a question for me. Was it really Pride that wanted to get him back in that rematch knowing that he had this injury? Or was this a push because of the contract that was already set in place for him? You know, I think that this pandemic, it's benefiting him because it's going to allow his arm to rest up a lot more, where it's going to be a second guess if they would have stepped in July.
That makes perfect sense, Dave. The only thing I'm not sure about, because I haven't had the chance to speak to Deontay Wilder since a couple of days after the fight, and it's something I'll ask him when I get the chance to do it, but I'm not sure if he would have had – I don't know how bad the tear was in his biceps. I don't know if it's something that he got because he knew he had more time now, or if it was something that he would have had to have had anyway. I don't really know that. So maybe it would have been something that he just fought through. I'm not saying that's a good idea, but maybe it's something that he would have done just because he didn't want to let go of the third fight. You know, because if the pandemic wasn't happening, you know, maybe Fury would have used that as an opportunity to fight someone else. And then what if someone knocks off Fury or something? You know, who knows what could happen? When you relinquish contractual control of the situation, who knows what happens? So I think maybe that might have been part of it. But it's worth asking Wilder, I think. Did you get the surgery because you knew you had to get it?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it you knew you had this extra time to deal with and it wouldn't have mattered?
Yeah, that's something I would love to ask him and find out, because, you know, it changes everything, you know, of what – you know, I mean, here, listen. Regardless of what – Wilder has said after the loss to Tyson Fury, the excuses that kind of rolled out, I still respect the kid a lot because he didn't need that rematch, number one. Number two is he always shows that he goes out there and he leaves it in the ring, right? You know, I don't know if there was a lot of pride, you know. I mean, obviously pride was affected there because his ego was, you know, tarnished, was beaten pretty bad, you know. So I respect him in that sense. I think he embodies what a fighter really is. You know, there's that arrogance that we love out of our fighters. You know, that they believe, hey, I can't be beaten. You know, there's no way this guy beat me this way. You know, I and whatnot. You know, so like I said, you know, that would be my question to him. Was it really because you wanted to get back in there, or was it because you were obligated to a contract on this particular date? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, money is always going to factor into it, Dave. I mean, they all have a lot of pride and everything. And it always makes me laugh when people said, oh, he's arrogant. And he, you know, he's so full of himself. I'm like, yeah, you can't do this for a living without being full. I mean, come on, you know?
Exactly.
So if it helps him sleep at night, you know, and it makes him, you know, it helps soothe his ego or whatever, to think that the suit was the costume was the reason that this happened. And I'm not saying it had nothing to, I don't know what his legs felt like. I wouldn't imagine that putting a 40 something pound costume on and then having that ring entrance drag out the way that it did. I wouldn't think that helped, but if it was a real factor to the degree that he said it is, I just would have kept it to myself probably, but I'm not a professional prize fighter. I mean, I don't know what it's like to be in that situation. So, but because no good could come of him because people are making fun of him now in terms of, you know what I mean? If that was really the case, just kind of know that, go back into camp, make the corrections you need, and then just come out with, I don't know, something that Mike Tyson used to would throw a towel over your head or something. Don't do anything crazy coming into the ring.
Exactly.
And just see what happens. You know, I don't know, but you know, Wilder is a very likable guy. You know, his story is incredible, where he came from starting boxing so late and then becoming one of the most pulverizing punchers we've ever seen in the history of the sport. It's an incredible story. Now it's up to him to correct what happened on February 22nd. Luckily for him, he's guaranteed the opportunity to do it. And now it's up to him to make the most of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of things that you have to look at what happened with Wilder, you know, but not take away what Tyson Fury did that night to him. I thought he had executed a phenomenal plan, a Kronk's plan that they gave to him to use against Deontay Wilder. But the massaging of his legs, when I saw that immediately, I was like, holy smokes, Do they not remember Thomas Hearns when he got in with Marvin Hagler? You don't massage their legs. You don't get them too relaxed. Then the suit, we don't know how much, you know, the weight of the suit could contribute. Him sweating in that suit can contribute. There's a lot of factors into there, you know. We know, as you know, a lot of fighters have these superstition rituals, you know. And maybe Deontay Wilder should knock that one away of wearing these, like, over-the-top costumes, you know, in his ring interest and go into the gladiator state of what Mike Tyson should do, as you mentioned, with the towel. Let me ask you about Devin Haney, because you brought him up, okay, how this is going to benefit him. Well, you know, what I've noticed is that some fighters right now, having all this free time, can sometimes get caught up a little bit too much in the moment when doing interviews. Devin obviously got caught up in the moment of taking a page from Bernard Hopkins when Bernard Hopkins was going to verse Joe Calzaghe by saying, I would never let a white boy beat me. Do you think he got caught up in the moment of – no, let me ask this. Let me rephrase this. Do you think it's really racism when he was bringing up, or was this a fighter pumping at his chest?
Yeah, look, it was inadvisable what he said. I mean, even if that's the way he feels – saying that in a public forum is not going to go over well, obviously. I don't know what he was thinking in that moment. You know, maybe just, I don't know. I, it's hard to explain what he was thinking, because the one thing I'll say about Devin Haney, in my interactions with him, he's a very respectful person. He seems very smart for and mature for a young guy. He's only 21 years old.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of 21-year-old people, and not just boxers, but other 21-year-old people, and he's seems much more mature than those people. He's been groomed to do this his whole life. I mean, he's been meant to be in the spotlight and everything. And look, people are not going to forget it, because it was a pretty ignorant thing for him to do. But he knows that. And he said, look, he apologized for it. And he said, it was foolish of me to do it. I understand why it was wrong. And you just have to take him at his word, because he has no other history of doing anything. The kid's never, as far as I know anyway, has never been in any trouble or anything like that. He has always, to me, come off like a respectful, smart guy. So let's hope that that's what he really is, and that was just, a blip in his history that will not reflect well on him, but that he can overcome. Because again, I don't think he's a malicious – he doesn't strike me as that kind of guy. Right. Maybe it just got caught up in – but the one thing I will say is it's on him. That's his fault. People were saying, oh, he was on a – he was goaded into it on a YouTube channel. I watched the whole interview.
Yeah.
And I didn't see anyone prompting him to say anything about race or anything. They were reading questions that were – or comments from people. I don't know how it works exactly, but you pay $5 and you get to ask him or say something to him and he responds to it. And to me, the question didn't seem to be about race. He seemed to bring that up on his own, which obviously everyone found surprising. But the other thing is, he took ownership of it. He didn't say, I don't know how he could have said it was taken out of context or anything like that, because it was there. It was plain as day what he said and how he said it. But he took ownership of it. He took responsibility of it. Hopefully, he learns from it. And when when we come back to business here, he's better for it in some way.
I got to agree with you with everything you just said right now. I mean, I think the kid owned it. He said it. He owned it. I had a very light conversation through text with Mario Serrano, who is his publicist. And I was like, hey, are you guys going to still do any interviews? Because I had just had Devin Haney on the show. And he was like, no, not right now. He's on the backpedal. And I was like, that's a good PR right there, buddy. Yeah, I think I would – put it stop for a moment, allow them to collect themselves and kind of rethink the strategy of collateral damage that they had to do. And I think he did a great job. He's a very well-schooled fighter in and out of the ring. His father, I've had a chance to speak to him as well. Very smart guys, and I think he got caught up with the moment, man. Keith, again, man, I want to thank you for coming on, leaving the ring, and talking with me boxing here on the show, man. Much appreciative. Got to have you on again more regularly here on here, man, because I had a great time. You're full of knowledge and one of the most respected writers in the game.
Yeah, hey, Dave, I really appreciate it, man. I appreciate the kind words. I appreciate you having me on. And, I'd love to do it again. So just let me know. And Hey, you and your family, stay safe out there, man. I know it's a crazy time for all of us, and you said your wife works at a hospital and everything, so, you know, keep her safe out there, and, you know, we'll do it again for sure.
All right, brother. Here you guys are, man. Keith Attic from Boxing Scene and your host, Dave Duenas on Leaving the Ring. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Don't forget to go and hit the subscribe button, hit that like button, and hit that little bell for notification to let you know when we go on live here on Leaving the Ring. Everybody, have a great, great, great week. Enjoy it with your family. Stay safe. Wear your mask. Wash your hands. Don't be an idiot, okay? And don't drink chlorine or inject yourself with Lysol or anything like that. All right? Take care, guys.